An interview with Campbell Wade, December 29th, 2003. And ending.
Okay. And we'll just start there. We'll make sure it's running.
Yep.
We got it.
I'll not try to anticipate your questions because you know where you're starting.
Well, tell me about the coffee break.
Well, that was right after the IAU meeting in 1961 that was held in California. And probably September, and Dave Heeshan came back from that meeting. He was not yet director. He was sort of the chief scientist of the organization, and Otto Struve was still director, and Heeshan became director a little over a year later. But at this time, of course, the big problem with radio astronomy was getting resolution on things you were mapping or whatever. And one approach was aperture synthesis. That's a term that I think went back to Sir Martin Ryle, who was one of the leaders in it. I don't think that myself that Sir Martin ever gave full credit to other people like Bernie Mills in Australia, or even Joe Pawsey in Australia, who also had significant ideas that he built on, but that's a personal opinion. But this was a big talk, aperture synthesis, at the IAU meeting, and so Dave Heeshan came back all fired up over it. And so it was an afternoon coffee break, I think September 1961, which in my mind is where the VLA project really got some sort of existence started.
Where were you?
This was in Greenbank, mm-hmm. Greenbank cafeteria. Curiously enough, I think I remember exactly where the table was we were sitting at. I have a rather geometrical memory, and so it seems to work that way. I'm right sometimes. Well, Dave Heeshan got to talking about all this. The other people there, since I remembered, I know I was there, and since he was talking, I know he was. I'm pretty sure that Dave Hogg, who you probably know, was there. He was a graduate student then. And Frank Drake and Roger Lenz, who left in REO in the next year or two. So they were never really connected to the project in any constructive way. But Dave made quite a speech, and we began kicking around, well, what if we build an array, what should it be able to do? Well, gee whiz, maybe it should have a beam width of 10 seconds of arc, which is unheard of small in those days. Now we go down to thousands, but you've got to remember this was over 40 years ago. And so it was discussed until everybody's tired of it, and we went back to work. And not a lot happened immediately, except I think there was general agreement that something like this ought to be done. We had no one on the staff with any experience in that sort of thing. And so we had to learn a lot. Most of us could spell aperture synthesis, and that's about as far as we could go. So, is there more that I should try to drag up about the coffee break?
No, that's good.
But I really think it took form at that point. This had been in people's minds at various levels of seriousness, I'm sure, but I'd wondered about it, but oh, heck, I don't know about that. I've got this stuff I've got to do right now. But also, I'll mention one opinion I've got that perhaps some would disagree with me on. I don't think so, maybe. I think Dave Heeshan was very much the father of the VLA. He provided the impetus, the sort of leadership that kept the project all headed in one direction instead of several directions. He kept that going right through. I think he would have resigned the directorship of NREO earlier had it not been that he wanted to see this project get going. He had a strong belief, you know, that 10 years was the absolute maximum that anyone stay in a job like he had there. And he stayed with him for 16. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what made the difference. So if they ever name that thing after somebody, it ought to be Dave Heeshan. He'll go into modesty routine or something. He raises yeah, with him, but I do think that the credit goes there. Of course, he didn't do it by himself. A lot of people made contributions, but he and very few others made more than their share of the contributions. Barry Clark comes to mind. So anyway, what do we do next here?
Well, what was your first initiation to aperture synthesis yourself, your first hands-on aperture synthesis activity?
Well, remember this wasn't born in one piece. I came to NREO from a postdoc in Australia. I got down there in December of 57 and left in December of 59. Arrived as father of one and left as father of two. You know, one of these transitional times in one's life.
And let me interrupt a second and ask you a question. So is your undergraduate degree from Harvard?
Yes.
Okay, so that's where you were doing your first radio astronomy.
Yeah, that's another story, but because I think this is about the BLA and not about me, but yes, I got started there.
And right, and then
I was involved in the Harvard Radio Astronomy Project.
Yes.
And some people blame me for being one of the centers who got it going, but members and undergraduate, let's see, I'd come out of the Army.
Uh-huh.
And 2 years of college behind me, I picked up again. Going back to being an undergraduate after being a platoon sergeant, that was a sort of loss of status, you know. I guess maybe I was a little bit brash. So anyway.
And then you went back to Harvard. You got your undergrad, and then
yep.
What did you do?
And I got a master's, and I finally finished up the doctorate. I finished all the work, the oral exam, everything in 57. And the degree itself actually is dated 58, because that was the next time to confirm.
And that was at Harvard as well?
All 3 degrees from
and
Harvard.
And then you went to Australia.
Yep, and radio physics, which is, well, let's see. Do you know all the alphabet soup, or people forgot? CSIRO, Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial
yes,
Research Organization, and I was in the radio physics division, which did the radio astronomy, and it was a real privilege to be there because I was working with real pioneers, you know, and it was a great education. And well, let's say I took the job offer I had that paid the least, and it was the right thing to do.
So that's where you got interferometry work?
I saw it.
Saw it.
I did not participate in it. I quickly learned to admire Bernie Mills very much in Mills Cross. It's probably a familiar name to you.
Oh, I didn't realize I meant to put those two together.
No.
Okay.
No, Bernard Y. Mills, for some reason known to everyone as Bernie, and he is one of that handful of people I've known in this business who is brushed with genius. And like most legitimate geniuses or genii or whatever you want to call it, he's really quite modest about it, but not shy either, you know. And there are a lot of bright people there. Arguably, my feeling was he's perhaps the brightest of the lot, but there are other people who are ahead of him in places, so this isn't worth arguing.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that he had excellent insights. He had got the Mills Cross, 85 and a half megacycle cross, working shortly before I arrived there. I mean, within a year, something like that. I don't trust my memory on that, but it was that order. And that certainly was doing a lot of what one would call aperture synthesis. What you're doing is taking a distributed aperture and making it produce a beam you could do radio astronomy with. What he was not doing, that Ryle did later on, was he was trying to make it act like a single dish. So he produced a beam in real time. Ryle spread out the job a little more, as we wound up doing here. Where you don't really have a telescope until you've run these noises through the computer. But Bernie was trying to produce things that looked like it came out of the dish. I don't think there's any fundamental difference between that and what came later. Is there a real pedant to my claim there were some? But I don't think the... well, for one thing, you have a certain amount of information striking your collecting elements, which we call an antenna of some sort. And what you do with that information is various, and so the labeling that we put on reflects more about how you handle information than what that information is or where it comes from. I'm getting very much into personal opinions here.
That's
because
fine.
You get a lot of argument on others. But that's the way I see it.
So you saw interferometry.
Oh, yes, and I worked with another cross that Alex Shane had built, the 19.7 megacycle cross, which was big, and it stretched something over 3,000 feet, I guess. And that, my involvement there produced very little, because when I left Australia at the end of 59, we had a great ream of data. Then Alec became fatally ill and died rather promptly. Here's a guy probably not past 40, and he had something like 8 children. I mean, it was just horrible. Stomach cancer probably got back to what these conditions under which he lived in the islands during the Second World War. He's an Australian infantryman, and those guys suffered a lot. And there are weird things that get to your system and so on. That was a speculation. Point is that all the data disappeared. No idea where it ever went. So I didn't have any real published result from there. But I did play with this stuff and got some feeling for it. But nothing would make me an expert. I was following somebody else's leader. So there were three crosses down there. There was Bernie Mills' cross that was the first. It may have been done a year before I got there, but not much more than that. There was the Shane cross that I mentioned. And then there was what they call the Chris cross. That was named for Wilbur Christensen, and he was known to everyone as Chris, and brother-in-law of the head of the Communist Party in Australia, leading to definite conversations at times. And the Chris cross was different because it was an array of dishes instead of dipoles.
Oh, okay.
And so they're separately steered. It was working during the time I was there, but I had no personal involvement with it. I'd walk over and watch it clank along, but there's more to participation than eyeballing it. So I worked with some of the data from Bernie Mills' cross, but I had nothing to do with taking the data, as I recall. If I did, it was pretty tangential. But I did work pretty hard with Alex's cross. Anyway, I had a feeling for all this when I came back from Australia at the end of 59, left to Greenbank, went on a payroll there on Groundhog's Day, 1960, and had not yet developed the appreciation of my own ignorance that came later, but anyway, that's sort of the normal history here.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was the background, and then when Dave Heeshan comes back a year and a half later or so from that meeting, certainly it wasn't as strange to me as it would have been otherwise, and it looked like fun. That was 61. Not much happened at first. Everybody's very busy. All of us except Dave Heeshan, I think, were desperately working to get tenure or something because we wanted to be able to feed our kids and all that stuff. And the next tangible thing that I did with this, really, apart from occasional discussions, I spent 3 weeks in California, both in Pasadena and up the Owens Valley Radio Observatory, where under John Bolton, he built the Interferometer with 290-foot dishes, which was very much a pioneer in this one. And again, a lot of the techniques that one uses with this were worked out there. It's always dangerous to, in a business like this, where you're dealing with an idea whose time has come, to start handing out credit. People build on each other's work. And I have never seen science as appropriately an ego trip for anyone. I know it works that way in some cases, but I do think it's the game and not the players that ultimately make the difference. And so I never claim too much credit for myself, and I think I hurt some feelings by not being too quick to give it elsewhere either. That's again, personal prejudices. And
so you spent time there?
Yeah, I spent time there, observed what they were doing. I do not at this time recall doing anything really hands-on. I was looking over shoulders, trying to understand what they were doing. They were doing some things in very primitive and laborious ways, which are all right when you're starting, you know. Any field, you don't start out with a finished product, or it's not much of a field, but I remember having a feeling there as I watched them working a horribly laborious way of handling the data. We've got to do better than that if we get into this. For one thing, NREO is a visitor-oriented organization. You've got to have instruments and techniques and supporting structure that will let people who don't know the instrument very well, but who do know the science, do good science with it. That's what it's for. And it was not anyone's, to anyone's discredit, that things were so laborious then, because they were pioneering it. And so that was all right, but I did come away impressed with the fact that one place we could make some headway was how we handled the information. There were a lot of other things I saw there that impressed me very much. John Bolton died a few years ago. But he again is one that I think is touched with a bit of the dusting of genius.
And he was Australian, wasn't he?
He was actually an Englishman who worked in Australia. He emigrated out there probably at the end of the Second World War. Now, a person who knows John Bolton much better than I is Barry Clark, because he worked under Bolton there. Mm-hmm. Barry cut his teeth on that interferometer.
That's
there.
That's right.
And Barry has a much more profound mind than I do anyway, so you've got to talk to him if you haven't done it already. Barry's another one who was definitely piled with genius dust. Probably the brightest guy I've ever known, but that's a dangerous thing to say because there are other people who think they should get the laurels.
I think everybody would be in pretty classic agreement over Barry.
Yeah, no, he is exceptional as a human being and as a scientist. And anyway, I learned a lot, as I said. And I know I had one idea that didn't bear any fruit then, maybe didn't ever. But I got interested in what we might do with fiber optics to replace the cables. And I went up to Silicon Valley, actually, south of San Francisco. Spent a couple of days there, saw the much smaller Yeah, probably they had it at Stanford. It was Ron Bracewell's project. It was interesting. Good people. I did go and visited some of the industrial establishments that were busily developing fiber optic techniques, and it's pretty evident that this might be promising, but on the time scale we were going to be thinking of, it wasn't ready. Mm-hmm. So we dropped it, but I told some people about what I'd seen there and why I'd gone up there, and it was, I think, an idea that was there before its time, and I don't think it bore any direct fruit in this, but now you see, they're doing it. One reason I checked it out was I was so ignorant about it.
Sure, that's how you learn.
It's indeed the way you learn. And all that time, so at this stage, you know, I'm 31, 32, beginning to settle down a bit from the sort of ego that one develops in graduate school, where you actually think a PhD means something. That's why you're working for it. Went back, and I was doing other astronomy with the, well, at that time, the only instrument we had working at Green Bank of any significance was the first 85-foot telescope. You're personally familiar with Green Bank,
yes,
too?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, okay. So this is what we called 85-1 when we built the interferometer and hooked the two movable elements on it. And am I doing rambling here and you should be calling the shots?
No, you're doing just fine. Keep going.
Because I'm basically giving you a time-ordered stream of consciousness, which depends upon an untrustworthy memory, but I'll, it's as honest as I can do it, but that's, I know people
will
disagree.
Well, if I need exact dates, I know where to check those.
Okay.
So that's fine.
Yeah, I can check my police record. Anyway, I've got a son just retired from the Albuquerque Police Department. Anyway,
he works on the 85-foot?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a single dish work.
Right.
Yeah. So
how far away was the 140-foot?
Oh, same distance it is now. about a quarter of a mile, I suppose. It's been a while since it. Like that. Yeah, it's probably a quarter of a mile, a little more down the road. And the 140 was being built at that time.
Okay.
And I was much involved in that. I think it was the only astronomer who was really involved in it, because aligning the axes and all that stuff.
Right.
I spent many nights up there freezing to death with the theodolite and tried to get it going. But that has nothing to do directly with VLA. I say directly because anything you learn with any telescope may pop up in somewhere.
Sure.
Some other place, you know. Well, anyhow, I think the next thing that I remember doing was, oh, probably about October into November, I wrote up a little thing which I circulated to some of the people around there, just about basically reflecting what I had learned and figured out about aperture synthesis. And the way I was setting it up, I know I was thinking of how one makes it work with computers so you don't have to do all this rice paddy type labor that I saw going on at Caltech. I don't recall a lot of the particulars now about it. I just remember being impressed that I was sure there's an easier way to do it than they were. A fellow named Nigel Keane is from England. You probably heard his name. Very loud, brash, bright, but kind of hard to work with in many ways because he was so very opinionated. There's some people say that it's a typical English intellectual, but I'll not comment. Nigel was more or less hired to work on getting some of this stuff together. Nigel and Dave Heeshan never hit it off, and Nigel wound up leaving. Nigel's energy had a lot to do with getting the interferometer started. I myself feel that he left at the right time because that kind of energy that helps launch the ship isn't necessarily what you want to sail it across the ocean. And if that analogy is clear to you, then I need say no more.
That's right.
Nigel, in fact, got out of astronomy altogether. He was very British, very anti-German. He could remember hearing the bombers overhead. So what does he do? He goes to Germany, marries a German girl, becomes a German citizen. Last I heard, he was involved in German politics. The guy was not totally consistent, you know. And another person who was around then, I think, probably, someone else would have to check me on this. I don't think he was at Green Bank primarily because of our interest in the array, but his talents were used for it. It was a Frenchman named Marc Finocchio. Does that name mean anything?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
In fact, Mark, the three of you, didn't the three of you write a paper? Whew. You and Vinokur and Keen, because I've seen those three names together.
We were doing the same things. I do not remember actually writing something, but, you know, after you write a bunch of this stuff, it falls apart.
It runs together.
I certainly was much associated with them. Mm-hmm. I got along with them. It took some doing in both cases, because Mark is a typical fiery, chauvinistic Frenchman. And he was very short, wiry, one of the fastest walkers. I'm a fast walker, but he could keep up with me and even pace me a bit, and he's probably at least 6 inches shorter, maybe more than that, maybe 8 inches shorter. And
So the three of you were the ones who worked on the interferometer?
We weren't the only ones. See, what I can't really remember now is when other people began coming into the effort. So you'll have to bear with me on that. Mm-hmm. Some of them may come back to me. I'm talking about stuff I haven't thought about in years. I'm just dragging it up. So
I'm impressed that you remember the names. If it was me trying to remember 2 years ago, I'd be...
If you get mad at people often enough, you remember their names. Okay. But Mark was, he was actually from Algiers, well, Oran. This was the time, you know, the French were busy being thrown out. Right. His parents were there, sort of a dangerous place. He's Jewish. And so he's very bright and very kinetic, a combination of French and Jewish, I think, often leads to a very fiery, focused mind. And Mark was an interesting person to work with, awfully bright. It was a great concession for him to admit that anyone else's ideas had merit, but he was willing to do it. And I think part of that's the inferiority complex that you so often see in short men. They feel they have to make up for something. If you're over 6 feet, you don't give a damn. I'm blessed to have been in that category. Okay, Larry Daddario. Larry Daddario, in a lot of, in many ways, very similar to Vinokur, though I'm not sure they ever knew each other. I'm trying to think they didn't. Because Vinokur was gone. Vinokur was at Green Bank maybe 2 years. I think he left early 64. Earlier than that. But he had a lot of very good ideas, and one thing I welcomed was his skill with what then was called information theory. I guess that term is still used, but possibly with a change of meaning. And very strong on the mathematics of the game, and certainly very expert in setting up the kind of problems that you wanted to get a solution to. One of the problems a lot of us had, and I think I did too, was taking the fact that we recognized something here needed to be analyzed, but not having that feeling for it so we could set it up in terms that could be solved. Mark was very good at that. And so we, even though he'd drive you nuts at times, I was awfully glad he was around. And then he went back to France. He's diabetic, and I think by mid-60s he was dead, which is quite a loss. And Keane, of course, I've explained his suit. Well, it was this document that I wrote. I reckon it was my own work, my own thinking, but I know also it had to involve mental enrichment from these other guys. And so that was circulated. And that was circulated about the third week in November of 1963. And you probably remember what happened then. Mr. Oswald shot President Kennedy. And I know it was that same week. And so nobody paid much attention to this thing I'd written. In fact, I sort of forgot about it myself. And that really was, you had to have been younger than we were at that time. So it may not have made the same kind of impression. So.
Oh, it's one of those days I'll remember.
Yeah, well, I was working on a notebook with some stuff on galaxies. I wrote in the margin, they tell me the president was shot.
Wow.
Right there. That sort of thing. All right. Yeah, it's a week before I turned 33. So, yeah. By which time I had some family responsibilities. Anyway, it was during 64, as I recall, there was a lot of action that was taking form on the ground. We were well aware that we did not have in-house the expertise that one needed to build, what was it, basically a collection of hundreds of interferometers. 27 elements out there, you get 351 pairs. Each one can be legitimately regarded as an interferometer. And so we raised the money from NSF to build the second 85-foot antenna, which was on that great collection of tires, which I don't know if that's still there. The last time I set foot on it was in Green Bay, 1989, so I don't know what the condition of those antennas is now.
Well, they're still there. The two on the track are still there, but I don't believe I ever saw the machine or moved them.
Well, they just used a couple of bulldozers.
Oh, just bulldozers.
Yeah, jockey them along.
Okay.
There was not an actual track initially. It was a roadway.
That's
and
right.
Then you had this great number of tires under there. And great adventure every time I moved an antenna. And then, it was about 1964. We were getting that thing running. And it wasn't too sudden. So in 63, a lot of the preliminary work had to be underway, but I don't remember the details now. But I do know that by the summer of 1964, we were actually trying to get fringes between the two 85-foot antennas. The third 85-foot came several years later, and that went operational, if I recall, in 1970. A fair bit later. I can date that because the work Bob Jomi and I did, first science off the three-element interferometer, is where we discovered the radio emission stars. You see what I have to rely on for this. I never kept a diary. When I retired 10 years ago this week, I kept nothing. I figured I was done with it. There are other things I wanted to do. I come fill up a rather small house with that junk. So it went. So I can't give you pictures or documentation of any sort. I didn't even save my reprints. Just tired of it. Well, 64 was an important year in this because 64 was the year we actually had a working interferometer. It was an instructional tool. It didn't do much science right away for two reasons. It wasn't good enough to do the science, and the other thing is that we hadn't learned how to use it. Now, people who are much involved in that thing, I know Barry was. He was doing most of, if I recall, most of the programming. But he wasn't immediately, because he didn't come until the fall of 64, if my memory serves. So he shows up here. But we had already done a lot of work then, and I do know some of those long summer nights down there, the ionosphere would build up. And I'm probably familiar with the system. We had a receiver on each antenna, and we, that stage, boy, I can't remember if we were recording signals separately or had, were combining them electronically. I know we had great amounts of cable there for the ley line, because you have to have the path link the same, unless you have an infinitely narrow bandwidth when you can get away with everything. We didn't. So we take the radio frequency signal, and I think we were doing this first at 1400 megahertz. I might be wrong with that. We may have been doing the 2695, I think, the 10 centimeter. See how good my memory is. Dave Hogg might be a good person to straighten out this, because he was very much involved. He'd gotten his degree by this time. He's no longer a graduate student. I was down there not so much to work on specifics as more to keep the whole thing balanced. I was involved in a lot of things. I was trying to look and see where the holes were. How useful that function was, I'm not sure, or how well I carried it out, I'm not sure, but that was my involvement. But I sort of, the advantage was I sort of saw everything that was going on, which I've now forgotten. But anyway, remember some of the ironies, one of the sort of things you learn a lot from. We had not yet had learned how to shield and ground things properly so that we didn't have extraneous signals running through the equipment. Particular extraneous signals that were giving us fits there for several weeks were Radio Moscow getting into our intermediate frequency from somewhere over there, and the Voice of America from North Carolina or wherever it was, and we had these signals, neither of which was wanted, in there completely drowning out what we're trying to work with. And we corrected the problem and learned a lot of useful things by learning how to shield things, the grounds where they were needed, and we got rid of the problem. Then we began to get signals you could do some astronomy with. Along with this, it's not enough to have this instrument. You have to calibrate it. You know, you know where to put the numbers on the dial. And I got very much involved in that. And this was building directly on what I'd seen in California a couple of years earlier. I wanted to automate the process, and there are still probably some reports I wrote here on phase drift, phase changes here, how one could take that information and use it to refine the geometrical constants of the array. It actually worked. And it was probably the first place where I made a real contribution to the effort myself, was because I did the work that made it possible to calibrate the thing accurately and easily. And I did write a bunch of memos on that. It probably exists somewhere. Dave Hogg might even have them. He doesn't throw away stuff the way I do. So,
you'd be astounded at how much Ellen has.
Ellen's an impressive lady. I never knew her terribly well, but everything I knew about her was good. She is so often ahead of the rest of us, you know. Besides, she went to Radcliffe, which isn't very far from Harvard, right?
Right.
Well, this led to one thing and another, and somewhere in here, it dawned on me. I think some other people are about to have the same idea at that time. It's one of these ideas as time comes. that we could actually, if we set up the prop right, we could make the interferometer calibrate itself to a large extent. And with that came the ability to measure absolute positions of radio sources. That was something I was much involved in, and I still sort of feel like, in many ways, the best thing I did. It's a chance to maybe do something for someone else, had, though I knew it was going to come very soon with other people. So, but that was important because it did basically make the calibration problem controllable. Now, whether anyone else remembers what I did then, I don't know. I suspect Dave Hogg, possibly Barry Clark. And this is not an ego trip for me, but I sort of groped for finding something useful I did in such company as Barry Clark, you know. And I think I had some success there. Well, once we were able to get information out of those two antennas, do some science with them, then we, I think we're really on our way. Something that never got written down couldn't be, I suppose, is the fact that we had to believe we could do it. This was very mysterious. None of us had done it. Well, Barry Clark, when he arrived from Caltech, of course, had experience, and that was very valuable. And in fact, when he arrived, I had just written paper on how we could take the digital output from the correlator and get calibrated fringes out. And I think that probably is still behind the way we extract the information at the VLA. I think the ideas are there. The details are very different than I know. And I believe the first memo that Barry wrote after he arrived was showing how I could have done it better. And he was right. So, but still somebody has to break the ice before somebody That's else right. can fall through without effort, you know.
That's right.
So, those were fun days because we were learning so much new. We were learning to believe in ourselves. I think of all my years at NREO, the ones I enjoyed the most were probably once I spent working with the Green Bank Interferometer. Because there I understood most of it. This thing up here, not even Barry Clark totally understands it. And I'm very uncomfortable putting my reputation on the line working with something that I don't understand. Well, I don't have an IQ of 10,000. And that's about what it would take to understand this. But still, those of us with more ordinary abilities could grasp it. One person I haven't mentioned here that should not be who should not be forgotten was Jim Coe. Does that mean anything to you?
I don't know that name.
He was the engineer who was working right with us on the interferometer. He was very good. He solved the problems on the delay line probably more than anyone else. I don't know enough about it to say where he made other big contributions, but I have a strong feeling, and I did then, that his presence was vital in that project. He's a very good, laid-back fellow, and the seeds of his destruction were there. He chewed tobacco. One of the few intelligent people I know who chewed tobacco. You've seen the billboards, you know, half off the tobacco. Well, that happened to Jim, and eventually killed him. And, you know, he still had kids in their teens and so on. Just awful all around. But I didn't know him well, but I knew him well enough to admire him greatly. So, Coe. I just hope his name can be kept in things.
Sure.
It's very easy to forget people like that. Well, other things going on then, I had not learned how to measure absolute positions yet. That came a bit later, but at least we got to the point where we could bootstrap our ways in getting the calibration constants of the two-element interferometer and relate it to the geometrical parameters, which we call position of a radio source. And several of us did collaborate on the paper, which was presented in early 65, given a list of positions which were very competitive with other people. Now, in 65, things began to get a lot more formal. I think I am right, but not too far wrong, in saying that Dave Heeshan did not want to proceed with a formal project organization until we had proven we could make a two-element interferometer work. So it would have been summer, maybe early fall of 1965 that there was a formal project organization, and my recollection is that there were eight of us on the staff who were a part of it. And first you had Dave Heeshan as the director, but he sort of kept his hands off, I don't know how well you know Dave. He's one of these guys who doesn't miss anything. And so he'll watch there, you think, he's just an administrator. Well, you're about to step on a nail. And I have a great respect for Dave in many ways. He's one of the few scientists I've ever known who's worth a damn.